thinking.
Right.
My name is Anne Lobia. I've spent most of my career in history teaching as a teacher trainer, working first in the London Institute and then at, for most of the time, at Bristol University. And I was also a member of the History Working Group for the National Curriculum.
Thank you. Anne, can you explain what drew you to the study of history teaching in the early 60s? And perhaps say a little bit about the focus of your research then.
I had done some teaching in two different schools, plus also the schools I was in doing my teaching practice. And I gradually became more and more intrigued by how far history teaching in schools was really history. How far was it a form of government propaganda? And I did a B.Lit degree in the end at Oxford University, trying to pursue some of those issues. It was actually quite difficult because the people who were interested in educational issues weren't interested really in the issue of history being propaganda. And the people with a real interest in history weren't interested in schools. So I found it quite difficult to do.
Right, and sort of before that, which has obviously led into the last question, what was your experience as a history teacher in London from 1959 to 61? Would you say that history teaching was changing during that period? And was there a kind of contrast between the experience that you had teaching in London and the grammar school in Oxford?
Actually, not quite what you might expect. I, in fact, did teaching practice in a very traditional, formal girls' grammar school, which was very much sort of teaching from the book and note-taking and so on. And I really felt quite strongly that selecting children at 11 was a far too rigid a division. So I was very much in favour of new comprehensive schools. And I went to teach in Mayfield, which was one of the 16 original London comprehensive schools, with a rather remarkable woman who was the head. And I can't remember how many streams we had, but it was arranged with three or four, you know, classes who, it was selective in that the forms were streamed, but they were streamed in broad groups, so that I had to teach children who were not, who would not have passed the 11 plus exam in those days and who were. I did not, on the whole, teach very slow children, and in fact, I think that there were specialist staff, and actually I shared a flat with one who was an extremely good teacher of slow children. I learnt a lot from her. But actually, Mayfield had quite high academic ambitions. And I think that it was innovative and ambitious in the way a fairly conventional curriculum was taught. There were limitations in those days. I mean, the whole business about, well, it's something I was going to say later on, but the whole business about using sources. I mean, reproducing material, to have resource material in the classroom, was just awful. As I remember it, with, I don't know whether anybody else remembers Banda machines, and the problems of getting hold of, even if you had slides, I mean, actually laying your hands on slides was very difficult. But then being able to get the slide projector, and you often had to organise for your class to go into a special room where there was blackout. The whole process of using a range of resources, as I remember it from there anyway, was a great deal more complicated than it is now. But I think the school was quite, I think Mayfield School was quite progressive and ambitious in what it was trying to do. Now, the grammar school in Oxford was interesting because it was actually a bilateral school that was about to be amalgamated. So it had a kind of secondary modern side. It was still called Littlemore Grammar School. And it was more a school that was, it was less ambitious, it was less lively than Mayfield, and as a result it was just generally duller, and one did try to teach, you know, across the board, but the process of amalgamation was happening when I was there, and it hadn't completely happened, and there were all the problems which occurred for many schools of teaching on divided sites, that sort of thing, which I remember as being quite complicated. So in many ways, I would have said that that comprehensive school, perhaps because it was a pioneer school, was the more interesting, lively, ambitious in terms of what it was trying to teach in the curriculum.
Was there a link between your teaching experience and this issue of political indoctrination via history, which you were interested in?
It's a question that sort of constantly arose. Maybe it was to do with the kind of textbooks one used at that time. I know what it also came from, though. Part of the training at the London Institute, and later on when I was a lecturer there, was that there was much more emphasis on the philosophy of history. You know, what is history? In all sorts of ways. And it's probably that, as much as anything, that made me continually ask about a school textbook. What kind of book is this? Is it actually a history book? I did write an article right at the beginning of my career, which was published in History, in which I said that I thought schools should do away with textbooks altogether, and that history in schools should be taught from a range of different sorts of books suited for the children, some of the more narrative books, some of the more exercise books, but never just one book, because that wasn't the way that adults did history. From just one authoritative book. So it's probably that also bothered me. And they're not easy questions to get to the bottom of. I'm not sure there are very tight or precise answers. I mean, in the very long run, I came to feel that school history is a special sort of history. It is, of course, related to other kinds of history, but it has pressures on it and issues which don't so easily arise in, say, adult history or academic history or popular history. You know, there are various related forms of history, and school history is in some ways distinctive.
And when you worked at the Institute of Education in the 1960s, what was some of the main issues facing history in schools? And was there a dominant current of thinking at the Institute about the way history should be taught?
It was broadly, if you like, the kind of the traditional approach. What David Sylvester, in an article that summarises this, discusses as the great tradition. What was in the curriculum was not hugely discussed. There was a lot of discussion in seminars of methods of teaching. And not only was there a considerable, actually I think now a very informed influence from philosophy of history of one sort and another, but also there were two other influences by departments in the Institute. One was psychology and how children learn. And we always had E.A. Peel, who was a friend of the head of the history department, who came and talked about children learning history and the sort of developmental and progression issues in it, which I found very interesting at the time. The other thing was language and use of language. Basil Bernstein was a very charismatic, influential figure in the Institute, and we did a lot of work on language and problems of the language used in teaching history. I think those are the main things. I mean, the head of the history department, I think I said this in something that I sent to Nicola, W.H. Burston did edit a handbook for history teachers, which I think was published in the early 1960s. A number of contributors, and it in many ways summarises the things that were thought to be important. There was also a book, which I meant to look up and haven't, by the IAAM, now wait a minute, it's Association of Assistant Masters. I can't think what the I stands for at the beginning.
Incorporated,
okay. But it was the IAAM, and it was, again, on teaching history. And those are the kind of approaches and views. But it's actually quite difficult to go back and remember what it was like in that period, because there was no national curriculum, there was no standardisation, either national there was a certain amount at a local level which probably grew through the 60s through the influence of regional history advisors who could exert a very considerable influence within their area, but that varied from area to area. And many schools were very free to decide what they wanted to do. In fact, the vast majority, three quarters, did an entirely predictable curriculum.
So what did the other quarter do?
Oh, there were schools that had very different approaches that had been influenced by some of the much older sort of progressive ideas in education. Things like, I'm trying to remember this now, the Dalton Plan, things that were essentially project-based work and weren't the kind of continuous, more or less chronological curriculum. Actually, all schools, the chronology was never absolutely continuous. All schools left out bits, but there was a fairly recognisable, traditional, more or less chronological approach going through the years of secondary school. But there were schools that did something very different, or who had, where was it, I saw that, a school that, you know, had one afternoon a week when they didn't do ordinary lessons, but they had just entirely project work in which pupils might be working on diverse projects, not all doing the same kind of thing. So there were some schools, but rarely. They weren't the norm at all, who did something completely different.
And were, did they also use different kinds of resources and aids, or was that fairly homogenous across the sector?
In general, at least three quarters of the schools did much the same sorts of things. The schools that were doing something completely different might possibly use almost entirely kind of homegrown materials. They might do things like a local study, an extensive local study using local materials. In fact, though, I mean, the resources and the materials that you could get were very much more limited then than they are now. And it would require a teacher with, you know, exceptional interest and energy and enthusiasm to develop entirely distinctive resources and materials, I think.
Okay. It's time. Yes, well, maybe I haven't stopped it. What did your 2 years in the USA add to your ideas about history teaching?
In fact, not a great deal, because I didn't teach in school. I taught in a college that was mainly a black college. I learned a great deal about race relations, about black Americans' perceptions of American history. I had enormous numbers of very interesting discussions. I once went to an education conference in Atlanta, in which I was one of about six white faces in an assembly of several hundred people, all of which were black. So I got a lot of a sense of that, but actually I was not involved with history in school, except that many of my students who came from often the poorer parts of North Carolina were amazingly and exceedingly ignorant about any kind of history. But it's a long time ago, and actually there's been something of a revolution over standards in history teaching in America since then.
Right. When you returned to work at Bristol University, and the school's council history project was just getting underway, how was it viewed by teacher educators at the time?
It in fact filtered in quite slowly. Bristol was different from the Institute of Education in London in that it was very considerably more child-centred, influenced by child-centred psychology and by the ideas of early progressive educators of one sort or another. So it didn't have quite this kind of traditional academic background that there was in the Institute of Education. That's not to say it wasn't academic, but it had a much more child-centred philosophy. And a lot of interest in child psychology, child development, how children develop, language work, things like that. But the history, the school's council project was quite slow to percolate, I think. And it really, what made a difference was into the early 80s. A lot of schools began to use some of the units from the school's history project, and particularly the one, What is History, was used quite a lot at the beginning of secondary school. The materials became available. Ah, yes, that's another thing. The local history education officer was a convert to school's history project, but also he had some money which he could give schools to get the materials. That was quite a draw and made a good deal of difference, I would think. I think I felt, and my colleagues in the university felt, that we did take account of it, and we were interested and got schools to come and report on how things were going when they tried out the materials. But in Bristol, we did not become, I don't think, sort of, you know, really strong advocates of the school's history project work. So it did have some influence. Actually, somebody wrote that before the GCSE, the school's history project was taken on by about a third of schools, more or less, you know, completely, and when they developed the exams for it. It had influence in about another third of schools, of one way and another, and there were perhaps left a third of schools that really took very little from it. And what made all the difference, this is something I did want to say, is that it was the coming of GCSE, in which the exam boards were, in a way, captured by the school's history project advocates. And to some extent by then, it had become a bit of a cult. And there was quite a lot of increasing, perhaps, opposition to the idea that one might be critical. I have to say that one of the things that certainly put me off was the idea of the history of medicine, which seemed to me remarkably esoteric subject for children in school to be studying, you know, as the line of development, as it were. And my husband was a doctor. The methods were very much used. But what happened was that with the GCSE, school history project methods became mandatory for everybody. And in fact, I knew teachers on courses in Bristol who came into me in real trouble, saying, we're now all being bullied, we're going to have to do school history project methods. There was one teacher who I thought was extremely good. He taught in quite a difficult school in Gloucester, and he developed all his own materials over quite a period of time. And they were a bit idiosyncratic, but they were very good, and they worked with his pupils. And he said, I'm going to have to scrap the lot, because GCSE required that you work to, what were they called in those days? Attainment targets. But you worked to things which were the aims of the school's history project approach to teaching.
And you later expressed scepticism about the teaching of empathy in your teaching history article 1989. Was this due to practical or theoretical considerations?
Both. And my views on that are known most from the empathy article in Teaching History. But in fact, I wrote a short article for the Times Ed Sub, which people noticed at the time but have forgotten about now, which, oh yes, it was actually called, when it was published, Feeling Doubtful. But for a long time, I called it Practicing Empathy with Joseph Chamberlain. Because it took, I took one of the questions which was then either being used or proposed for GCSE, which began, you are Joseph Chamberlain. And I just tried in that article to think through, how does one empathise with Joseph Chamberlain? For 25 marks it was at the time. And having been through this exercise, which was practical, because one of the points is that I didn't feel that I could empathise with Joseph Chamberlain. So the article ends by saying, I'm practising empathy with Joseph Chamberlain in order to get those 25 marks, but I know it isn't genuine, and I wonder if it's history. It's actually quite a complicated question, because I had always felt that imagination was very important in history. and particularly with youngsters, the things that get them imaginatively inside the Vikings or the rows over factory reform can often be something which acts as a stimulus to the imagination. And that makes the mass of material you're learning about, the facts, the details, meaningful. And without that, they remain inert. But I still think that imagination is the better term for several reasons. One, because imagination has been quite widely written on by psychologists and others. Very little, really, on empathy. And then empathy is in relation to people. Imagination can be in relation to situations, not just the people involved, but the physical situation in which they are and the sort of problems that they're facing. It seems to me imagination is a wider kind of concept, and that it can greatly aid historical understanding. It's also a concept which historians have written about. And by and large, historians haven't much written about empathy, even recently. But the real problem with empathy was when it was set for assessment. And the five levels of assessment just seemed to me ridiculous. You know, the notion that there were these progressive development in empathy. I hadn't done research on it, but it seems to me empathy or an imaginative understanding quite often occurs in a sort of a flash. It may be very partial. It does need to be checked against other things, but it doesn't work in a neat, progressive way. So it was the examining that most bothered me, which seemed to me to be pushing pupils into a wholly artificial kind of exercise.
You've written about teaching of history to younger children. How did you become interested in primary school history?
That's very simple. I was teaching a number of courses on in the master's degree at Bristol University, including one strand on history teaching, but also I did a thing on the course on the history of childhood. And there were a number of primary teachers who came to that. And it was teachers, primary teachers and sometimes head teachers, and a little group of them came to me at one point and said, what should we be doing in primary schools? And I said, I don't know, but I'll try and find out. And I then went and talked to the primary specialists in our department and then in other places. I discovered there was scarcely anybody who had any coherent ideas about what should be taught in primary schools in the way of history.
What year, just roughly what years are we talking about?
I need to look at the date.
Yeah, don't worry, we're matching.
I can't put an absolute date on it. This is 70s and early 80s. The date of the publication, of the first publication of that pamphlet with Joan Blythe. Eventually I met Joan Blythe. And she and I both came from a secondary background. We'd both been involved in teacher training, and we had both, for somewhat similar reasons, become interested in what should happen before you get to secondary school, and was there anybody who knew about it. And so we joined forces and wrote that little booklet for the Historical Association. And then we, together, there were some individual teachers and schools who did have ideas about history teaching, and we began to look them out and find them, and we eventually worked to get a primary group and a primary representation within the Historical Association. But it was originally that sort of question, and then you sort of get intrigued and you kind of build up an expertise. I visited any schools that I thought were doing anything interesting. And I also had teachers on the master's course who were doing research degrees, not always in relation to history, but whom I got to know. And they would invite me over to their schools to see what they were doing. And so I became quite interested in it.
Were you surprised to be invited to sit on the History Working Group for the National Curriculum in 1989? And do you think it was a worthwhile endeavour?
Ah. Yes, I was surprised. And I did think a bit about, you know, because you just get a phone call from somebody who says, I'm making a phone call from Downing Street, and the minister, Mr. Baker, would be interested if you would come to be interviewed. They must have said the history working group, but I can't quite remember. And you sort of think to yourself, did I hear that correctly on the phone? And then I thought, well, I would go for the interview. And in whatever the interval was, a week or two, I thought, you know, if I'm offered this, do I want to get involved? Because I could see that it might cause a great deal of trouble. And that, you know, were we going to be sitting in Mrs. Thatcher's pocket? And that kind of thing. So you do think about it beforehand. At least I did, and I guess most of my colleagues did too. But in the end, it was just very interesting. And it was too intriguing just to say, no, I won't have anything to do with it. So I did get involved. And I have to say, the earliest meetings were extremely interesting. Do I think the whole thing was worthwhile? Well, one of the questions I asked myself is, do I want a national curriculum? And my basic view was that a national curriculum could be a very good thing, largely because it was some kind of guarantee of entitlement for all children. And there were still schools which did pretty awful teaching. But I must say that I also thought of it initially as being, the national curriculum would be a sort of scaffolding, would be a very broad framework. And I have to say that I think, as it turned out, and perhaps it was foolish not to foresee this, added to the assessment system, it became far too detailed, far too prescriptive, in my view. It reminds me of, well, the present sort of thing about, you know, health and safety regulations. We do need health and safety regulations. They're not a bad thing in themselves. But in many respects, these days, I mean, I'm now talking about the contemporary city, they've just become far too pernickety, far too detailed. All sorts of bureaucrats get busy refining and improving. And detailed prescription is bad for teachers and for anybody's initiative, common sense, enterprise, democratic endeavour. We do need, you know, speed limits, health and safety regulations, a national curriculum, but not in too much detail, not from the centre anyway.
Before the national curriculum, there was an assumption that little history was being taught in primary schools. Was that your experience? And what do you feel the national curriculum aimed to do for primary history, and has it succeeded?
That's an interesting question. It is broadly true, and it was in HMI reports, but also I had one or two people who did small-scale surveys from Bristol, that the majority of primary schools did very little in the way of any kind of history teaching, and infant schools even rarer, and there were almost no resources. And I think that was pretty clearly the case. I do think that the putting it into the national curriculum did an enormous boost for primary schools. Not least because it stimulated the publishers to start producing some resources and textbooks and other things, because it was, you know, now in the national curriculum. But I have to say, because it was to some extent a new initiative, you know, looking at history as history and not just odd bits within various sorts of project work, and trying to build in something that was developmental, that was progressive, it takes time to establish that kind of thing in schools. I mean, it's all very well producing a report and, you know, suggestions about what should be done, but for it to be assimilated and worked through in classrooms and become a part of it takes quite a lot of time. And I think it was beginning to work, and I think there are HMI reports that say so. But it got overtaken by literacy and various other things. And I'm not up to date on this now, but I suspect that there is rather more history than there was before the national curriculum, but probably less than there was towards the end of the 90s.
Mm.
But there are, I mean, perhaps I should add in some other things on that too. Mm. There are some serious problems, and one which nobody ever addressed, and it really was silly, is that the vast majority of primary school teachers know very little history. And it's not their fault. They've done very little in their own education, not in their training as teachers. Many of them may not have done history for GCSE, and not after that at all. And quite a number might have done 1 year in secondary school, and otherwise have done humanities and other projects, project work, which had very little history in it, so that they know extremely little history. Now, all the training of teachers was done by educationists, and it was into methods. Actually, primary teachers are rather good on methods. They've developed them in other subject areas, many of which can be used in history. And they have quite a sophisticated understanding of linguistic problems and things like that. They just don't know anything much about the Vikings or the Egyptians, or, and nobody that I know of would give them, you know, short courses at sufficiently sophisticated level. I don't mean very sophisticated, for them to have some real conceptual understanding of the Vikings or the Egyptians, or, and the mistake was to put onto the curriculum some topics like the early Indus Valley civilization, for which there are remarkably few resources. And Egypt is easy because that has been around for quite a long time. There are lots of resources. There's quite a lot in museums. There are things which teachers can draw on, and they tend to find it interesting too. But they can learn kind of mechanically how to teach something about the Romans. But in fact, to simplify well, you need somebody who has a considerable understanding. And many primary teachers, there are real absurdities that occur in primary classrooms just because the teacher really doesn't know much about the Romans or whatever.
Just following on from that, as a trainer of primary teachers, what have been the biggest obstacles to improving the teaching of history, key stages 1 and 2, and have these been overcome at all with time?
No, that's really been answered in a way.
Yes.
By the last question. No, because the training does not consist, and for a little while I did get involved in some of the training of primary teachers under the national curriculum, and it's absolutely appalling. The time which is available for it is very small. A lot of it is optional because the teachers can't do all the options that they should do. And it's geared again towards methods and meeting objectives. It isn't towards trying to understand something about the Egyptians or the Romans or the invaders who came into Britain or whatever. It's very minimalistic. Some of the training could be done as in-service training, but again, there's a problem about in-service training too, because it's on educational method and how to use resources. It's not on what's important about the Vikings.
So if you were trying to improve the system, is that probably what you'd actually concentrate on, more content?
Yes, so that the teachers had some real feeling for the particular, rather carefully and narrowly chosen topics that they were going to teach. One isn't saying they need a broad historical education. Working with museum educators could be another way of doing this kind of thing. But it's almost as though, you know, you had somebody trying to teach music who had no understanding of music, and they can learn as a kind of exercise how to teach Bar Bar Black Sheep or something like that. But they have no feeling for music. So it becomes a dead exercise, and I think that happens too often with history. And I want to emphasise, it's not particularly the teacher's fault. They've had very little opportunity to really understand the subject matter.
In your work for the Council of Europe, have you observed any common issues related to the teaching of history across the European states? And is there anything unique about the teaching of history in England?
First of all, there are a great many things in common, particularly shortage of time, and you know how to make selections in the curriculum. But the general pattern of teaching has similarities across a number of European countries. But there are distinctive differences. In a number of countries, history is taught with other subjects. For instance, history and geography in France, history and civics in Denmark. The difference is, well, we use these activity or constructivist methods more than most countries, partly because they do derive in the end from things like the school's history project, and that has in turn influenced other countries in Europe. The amount of content we cover is, I think, less. Stopping history at 14 is one of the very distinctive differences. Probably the majority, and I'm not sure it's a majority, but quite a number of countries do continue history at least until 16. And some countries like Spain have sensibly recognised the connection between some historical knowledge in the population and tourism, because all sorts of people with various kinds of jobs in tourism, it's an advantage if they've got some real historical background in their education. So we tend to stop very early. We tend to have very activist sorts of methods, and rather less broad content. Another peculiarity is that the history of England or Britain is taught separately from any other kind of history, world history, European history. And there is no comparative perspective. The French curriculum, which is quite prescriptive, has got some very useful and thoughtful comparative perspectives in. And there are major movements like the Crusades or the industrialization, two world wars, the votes for everybody, which actually occurred in other countries too. They're not peculiarities of British history. And yet, the way history is taught in England, there is no comparative perspective. And that is a bit odd. And a great many of the smaller countries, mostly the smaller countries in Europe, do in fact teach the history of their own nation within a regional perspective, partly because the history often overlaps. It's difficult to teach totally separate from neighbours with whom the national history has been entangled. But on the other hand, all countries teach national history. And at various conferences and seminars I was involved in, there was general agreement amongst the teachers that 40 to 50% of the school curriculum is national history in one form or another. And another common feature is that from time to time, many countries have had what are often called history wars about what should be taught in the curriculum, with passionate feelings on either side. And a lot of publicity, the media always loves to get hold of it. So that again is not peculiar to Britain, that there's been debate. But the fact is that one has to make rather severe selections because of the time in school. But there are certainly countries, I mean it was actually in, it was a very good school in Russia, in St. Petersburg, and that teacher had set up, this was in the 1990s, had set up exchanges between her pupils and pupils in West Germany and somewhere else, I can't quite remember where. There were three-way exchanges, and she said it wasn't particularly with England, but I mean she said it was quite clear that her pupils, the senior secondary pupils, just knew far more history than the pupils in West Germany and wherever the other exchange place was. I can't remember where it was. And in general, that might be true, in that there is a tradition, particularly in some of the more Eastern European countries, of pupils really learning and assimilating large amounts of material. I don't mean just rote learning, but they seem to have a capacity to take in greater amounts of material than our pupils seem to manage. And it's partly something to do with the cultural tradition. The other thing is that Russian children will sit and listen to a good tape, to teacher exposition, for longer than is thought advisable in English schools. And in fact, of that particular school, I had an argument with another German consultant who was there about whether the children had been forced into listening. I don't think they have. You've only got to listen to the parliamentary speeches in Russia, 4 hours long. There's a tradition of listening which isn't really in our culture or has disappeared. I mean, Victorian children had to listen to sermons and did and survived. But it's partly to do with cultural patterns, actually. And what the expectations are with amongst teachers and in the exam system of what children are capable of at particular ages, particularly the more senior ages.
Finally, could you say a little bit about your experience in New Zealand?
Oh, that was in a way very interesting, because I did a small research project looking at history in New Zealand schools. Actually, history hardly occurs in New Zealand schools. It comes under social studies. So what I was really looking at is what happens to history in social studies courses, which are, or were in New Zealand and are in most places, largely present-centred. They're very often around contemporary issues, problems, things thought to be significant and important, and they are multi-perspectival. There'll be something economic, something social, and maybe a bit of history within a particular topic. But history used in that way does tend to disappear, and the way that the topics were thought out in New Zealand, but it was also true because I observed it in humanities courses in lower secondary, which were quite common at one time in England, and in project work in primary schools too, same kind of thing. The history becomes a sort of a little bit of informational background to whatever the particular topic is, in transport or whatever else it is. And there's no coherence to it overall and over a period of 3 or 4 years. And it almost disappears. And I wrote up that article and was actually urged to do it by several people who said, you can do it because it's easier for an outsider to do, which probably is true. I actually think that in the case of New Zealand, social studies was adopted probably from American influence in the 1950s and 60s because their traditional history courses had been very colonialist, modelled on British history courses of 50 years earlier or something, and they were felt to be irrelevant. But they didn't, it wasn't clear quite what to put in its place, and so social studies was a way of avoiding the problem of having some kind of social education in the schools, but not really facing up to what kind of history you might really want in a place like New Zealand in the second half of the 20th century. So that's was quite an interesting issue, I think.
And what kind of reaction was there to your...
There was immediately a certain amount, there were articles written in newspapers, a certain amount of discussion, but I think it was forgotten for another 20 years. And actually all countries have problems in their past or periods or issues in their past which they prefer to evade. The one in Britain is the Empire. I think from what I know of the present curriculum, many British children have very hazy ideas about what on earth the British Empire is or was. But it's what, large parts of the rest of the world do know about us. But in every country there are these things which are difficult to sort out and face in school. And then sometimes, you know, it will be faced up to and perhaps sorted out.
Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up that we haven't talked about that you think would be interesting?
I'm sure I'll think of lots of things. Ah, I know one thing that I did want to say, and that is that the move to more... The resources that are now available for teachers to use in classrooms are infinitely better than they were when I first became involved. And that is partly to do with the whole technological revolution. I mean, the means of reproducing things, of visual material, the ease with which it can be used in a classroom has accelerated in the last 50, 60 years. Technology alone doesn't necessarily make for good things. I mean, actually, the idea of the source method was first written about by Keating in 1910. I think he must have reproduced his sources by hand. I mean, the idea was there, and was there in some of the writing about how to teach history in schools, but actually physically trying to do it was infinitely more difficult. And there were attempts, things like the Jackdaws in the 50s and early 60s, where publishers took this up. But it's modern technological help has made a huge difference to the variety and interest that can be brought to lessons in school, I think. So that's one of the things that I really did want to say, I think. Anything else? No, not at the moment, not what I can think of. I might think of something in a minute, but there you are.
Well, thank you very much, Anne. That's been really interesting, and we hope that it's worked.